Gather around.
She's a good one. She's a cracker. I like that.
Yeah. She's something else.
She sure is.
We couldn't stand to the window.
All right, we're gonna jump right back into it. Everybody, I hope has had a good lunch. Got our batteries recharged. I got enough jalapenos in me to last for a while. We're gonna go start off on page 17, chapter 2. There is a solution.
Oh, thank God.
Yes. Hallelujah, there's a solution. We'll get to it in about 7 pages. All right. But this is pretty neat. You know, Bill lays out his story, and we've gone through the doctor's opinion, and they laid out, this allergy and all this stuff, and now they're going to dwell upon this step one stuff. They're going to dwell upon this loss of control and this loss of choice, and we're going to see where he takes us here. It says, we of Alcoholics Anonymous know thousands of men and women who were once just as hopeless as Bill. Nearly all have recovered. They have solved the drink problem. At first reading of that, it's a pretty innocuous little paragraph, but look what it says there. Thinking of the first 100, the people who wrote this book, thinking about to their success rate back in the day, nearly all recovered. Nearly all the people they worked with recovered from alcoholism. That's hopeful. That's some good stuff. And it says, we are average Americans. All sections of this country and many of its occupations are represented, as well as many political, economic, social, and religious backgrounds. We are people who normally would not mix. obviously we're from Dallas, and I did most of my drinking, 90% of my drinking was in Dallas. And I'm in these rooms or at these treatment centers or whatever, I didn't know a dang one of you. People who normally wouldn't mix, yet here we are. That's kind of a cool thing. It says, but there exists among us a fellowship, a friendliness, and an understanding which is indescribably wonderful. We're like the passengers of a great liner the moment after rescue from shipwreck, when camaraderie, joyousness, and democracy pervade the vessel from steerage to captain's table. And Joe and Charlie explain it, back in the day when you had to do a long trip, you didn't just hop on a flight, if you were going to Europe or South America or something like that, you went on a ship, and if you were an immigrant coming over here from Europe and you barely had a pot to piss in, you were in the steerage of you were in the bowels of the ship, and you barely got any fresh air. But at the other end of the spectrum, if you had the real money, big money, old money, Vanderbilt money, you might be asked to dine with the captain of the ship. Yet, when the ship goes down and there's a wreck, we're not asking each other for W-2 forms or anything. I don't care. You got a raft and I'm drowning. It don't matter. And that's what they're talking about here. But this is because this is important stuff right here. Unlike the feeling of the ship's passengers, however, our joy in escape from disaster does not subside as we go our individual ways. The feeling of having shared in a common peril is one element in the powerful cement that binds us. So he's saying right there that the fellowship that we have is one element that's going to keep us here. The treatment centers are telling me that I must go to 90 meetings in 90 days, keep coming back, blah, 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 blah. And those of you who have a bunch of desire chips know that there was a lot of times where I did not want to drink. Early on, I wanted the heat off. But towards the end of my drinking career, I did not want to end up where I kept ending up. And I'd get plugged back into the fellowship, doing 90 meetings in 90 days. One time I did 270 meetings in 90 days. I didn't have a job. I went to the noon, the 6, the 8. Day 92, 93... I'm looking for a tall building and a sniper rifle, and I'm taking some people out, But look at it. He calls it a powerful cement. So you folks know what epoxy is, right? It's two parts, hardener and a resin, right? You can have all the resin in the world. Ain't nothing going to stick to it. You got to mix those two parts together, and then you've got a powerful adhesive that'll hold anything. The fellowship is one element that keeps us together. The other element is the program. That's what keeps us here, is the program. Says, the tremendous fact for every one of us is that we have discovered a common solution, the program. We have a way out on which we can absolutely agree and upon which we can join in brotherly and harmonious action. This is the great news this book carries to those who suffer from alcoholism. And I'm just a big believer that we need to get into the program. Hey, the fellowship loved me to death. Don't get me wrong. I don't have anything bad to say. They will love me to death. Because I will drink to death. They'll tell me to keep coming back. I got to have a program in my life. There's an illness of this sort, and we've come to believe it, an illness involves those about us in a way no other human sickness can. If a person has cancer, all are sorry for him, and no one is angry or hurt. But not so with the alcoholic illness. For with it, there goes annihilation of all things worthwhile in life. Look at the words he uses in this book. I mean, you got to say this book, because he could have said, but there goes with it all the thing. He calls it annihilation. That's what I did to the things in my life that I supposedly cherished. I annihilated them with alcoholism. I destroyed everything in my path. It engulfs all whose lives touch the sufferers. You know, me being closed-minded, drinking back in the day, I was my motto was, hey, get off my back. I ain't hurting anybody. It's my life. But I annihilated all those people who cared about me. All my family members who love me dearly. It touches everyone. I mean, I challenge you. Go to Wichita. Go to the mall. Christmas time. People are out shopping. They'll be packed. Try to find one person in the mall whose life isn't touched by alcoholism. Let me know if you find somebody. Because we touch them all. Because whether it could be in my family an alcoholic, or I'm married to an alcoholic, or my mother or dad's an alcoholic, or my brother was hit by a drunk driver, or I had to fire it out, it covers the board. We touch everything. It brings misunderstanding, fierce resentment, financial insecurity, disgusted friends and employers, warped lives of blameless children, sad wives and parents. Anyone can increase the list. We hope this volume will inform and comfort those who are or who may be affected. There are many. Highly competent psychiatrists who have dealt with this have found it sometimes impossible to persuade an alcoholic to discuss a situation without reserve. Anybody been to psychiatrists or psychologists? Come on, I like group participation. Did you give them a fair shot? Did you tell them the truth? Come on. I was telling them the truth as I saw it, you know? Oh, come on, you put me on the Dr. Phil show, I'll make that man weep. Tell him my sad story, right? I'll make him weep. He ain't getting through. I'm going to tell him the way I think it is. But how about this? Strangely enough, wise parents, intimate friends usually find us even more unapproachable than do the psychiatrist or the doctor. Oh, when my mama starts talking to me about it? End of story. Mind snap shuts. Talk to the hand. Go away. Don't want to hear it. Look at this. Good definition of a sponsor. But the ex-problem drinker who has found a solution, who is properly armed with the facts about himself, can generally win the entire confidence of another alcoholic in a few hours. Until such an understanding is reached, little or nothing can be accomplished. That's my sponsor. He's suffering from the same affliction that I am. I'm the one who was dying. He wasn't. That guy spoke my language. We identified. It tells us about it in chapter 7. Who spoke Dr. Bob's language? Bill Wilson. Alcoholic number 3 is a classic example of this right here. They spoke Bill Dotson's language. Why? Bill Dotson had been going to church, been trying to quit drinking for years and years and years. When he saw that they knew all about the drinking game, he perked up. He was desperate. That the man who is making the approach has had the same difficulty, that he obviously knows what he's talking about, that his whole deportment shouts at the new prospect that he is a man with the real answer, that he has no attitude of holier than thou, nothing whatever except a sincere desire to be helpful, that there are no fees to pay, no access to grind, no people to please, no lectures to be endured. These are the conditions we have found most effective. After such an approach, here's some more hope. Many take up from their beds and walk again. You guys out there on the firing line see it all the time. people who are written off. Written off. Yet when they come into contact with one of us and we present the problem and we share with them our experience and strength and hope, those people who were written off can take up and walk again. None of us make a sole vocation of this work, nor do we think its effectiveness would be increased if we did. We feel that elimination of our drinking is the be-all, end-all. Oh, wait, my book doesn't say that. We feel that elimination of drinking is but a beginning. No, we stopped hundreds of times before. That was just the beginning. I thought that was the end of the game. Stop drinking. You take booze away from me back in the day, my life did not get better. It unraveled in a hurry. Elimination of drinking is but a beginning. Look where it is. A much more demonstrations of our principles lies before us in our respective homes, occupations, and affairs. That's where we practice these principles. You can give a monkey a big book and some flashcards, he can 12-step somebody, right? Anybody can go to an AA meeting and sit around and hear somebody all wise and got a lot of experience. I can hear something really witty at your little meeting, and I can parrot it and take it back to my meeting, and you'll pat me on the back thinking how great I am. I got to practice these principles in all my affairs. You know, I got to practice these principles with my family, with my friends, with my coworkers, people in the express line at Tom Thumb grocery store when they got like 23 items in the 15 or less. I got to practice these principles, you know. Drive me nuts. Here's my favorite line in the big book. Here's my favorite line in the big book right here because I love this one. It says, all of us spend much of our spare time in the sort of effort which we're going to describe. That's my favorite line. Why were they successful back in the day? Because all of them did this. All of them got a sponsor, worked the steps, and when they recovered, they went out of their way to seek out another alcoholic and carried this message. All of them did that. That translated into anywhere from 50 to 90% success rate, depending on whose math you count. All of them did that. It was not an option. My sponsor put it to me bluntly. First night back, he told me, well, hey, I didn't ask him to be my sponsor. He appointed himself. He says, John, I'm now your sponsor. You're going to call me when I tell you to call me. You're going to show up where I tell you to show up. You're going to read what I tell you to read. And the minute you balk, go away. Now, in those nice little discussion meetings, those little fellowshipy meetings, they say, oh, that's too harsh. No, that was the best thing for me. The minute I balk, go away. Go find another group that'll do it your way. Mm-hmm. 300 groups in Dallas, one of them's bound to do it your way. If you want to roll the way we roll, you do what we do. We're just doing it old school. We're doing it the way they did it back in the day. All of us spend much of our... You look at the vitality of our group in Dallas now. It'll blow your mind. You experience it here. People of like minds following these directions, doing this stuff. This is what we do. That is my primary purpose. A few are fortunate enough to be so situated they can nearly give all their time to the work. Clancy, out of California. Was it the first 2 years he was sober, he couldn't get a job? Lived in the back of the shelter that he was living at, doing odd jobs for them so they let him stay around. Couldn't get a job for 2 years. I'm the genius in the 90s that had burned up everything in my life, and as soon as I got out of treatment, it became imperative that first and foremost, I got to get the Holy Trinity, the job, the car, the girl. You know? Then I'll work these steps, you know. It's pretty amazing. If we keep on the way we're going, there's little doubt that much good will result. But the surface of the problem would hardly be scratched. Those of us who live in large cities are overcome by the reflection that close by hundreds are dropping into oblivion every day. Many could recover if they had the opportunity we have enjoyed. How then shall we present that which has been so freely given us? You know, I didn't come into AA looking like this. You know? I was in bad shape. But our tendency in AA today, it seems like, is, okay, now that we get sober and we've got our little home group and we come and we have our little fellowship, we make our coffee and do our little stuff, that, you know, we'll be there for the newcomer. Well, you know what? Our job is to go out and find the newcomer. See, we just take it for granted that those people out there know that we're in here. But the truth of the matter is there's people around in this community right now drinking themselves to death, and they have absolutely no idea what the problem is. They think it's the child abuse or the divorce or the finances or whatever it is. They got no idea what's killing them. How are they going to know unless we go seek them out? What are you going to, we're going to clean up, have a meeting in here, and wait for them to show up here? How are they going to show up if they don't know we're here? We have to get off our rears and go find them. Hell, I found a bottle. Right? I went to any lengths to get a drink. Any length. Drink some stuff that you're not supposed to drink. Me staying sober is no different. I got a big book. And I've had a spiritual experience. And I don't care where God puts me on God's green earth, I'll find a drunk. I can have me a meeting. I can't sit here all sober and stuff, wait for the drunk to show up to me. They may not know I exist. I got to go find them. We've concluded to publish an anonymous volume setting forth the problem as we see it. We shall bring to the task our combined experience and knowledge, not our theories, not our opinions, their experience and knowledge. This should suggest a useful program for anyone concerned with a drinking problem. Of necessity, there will have to be discussion of matters medical, psychiatric, social, and religious. We're aware that these matters are, from their very nature, controversial. You bet. Nothing would please us so much as to write a book which would contain no basis for contention or argument. We shall do our utmost to achieve that ideal. This book comes out in 1939. This book is now in, I don't know how many languages now. 40? Right?
56.
56, okay. All over the world. Christian communities. We got some guys in Iran right now translating our study guide. Doesn't matter. Doesn't matter what religious persuasion you come from. Doesn't matter. This spiritual principles are spiritual principles, whether or not you believe them or not. There's a great book. This is not AA related. There's a great book called The Spirituality of Imperfection. And it talks about spiritual principles. In any religion, any theology, anything, that's what these principles are. They contend with nothing. There's no contention. They don't conflict with anything. This translates easily into Spanish as it does to Russian. Doesn't matter. It's pretty cool stuff. Most of us sense that real tolerance of other people's shortcomings and viewpoints and respect for their opinions and attitudes, which make us more useful to others. Our very lives as ex-problem drinkers depend upon our constant thought of others and how we may help meet their needs. Constant thought of others. I'll tell you a little story. I wasn't sober very long, 2 or 3 weeks max. And this little job that I had quit, and they hired me back when I got sober, I had to do a little project for them, and I was the only one who could do it. And they didn't want me back, but they needed me back. And so they were going to have me work for a few days, do this project, and they were going to pay me cash, right? And I didn't ask. I started working for them, and I'm working, and a week goes by, and 2 weeks go by, and the project's still going on. We're wrapping it up. It's on a Sunday. I just know. And I've had a great Sunday. I've talked to my sponsor. I've gone up to this little treatment center, helped some guys out and everything. And I got home that Sunday night, and I'm thinking, man, I'm going to go to that job tomorrow, and they're going to fire me. And what am I going to do? I'm not going to have money to pay the bills. And next thing you know, I'll be living in a van down by the river. And, you know, it just snowballed, right? Manufactured fear, right? And I call my sponsor. He listened to me. He let me get it all out. And he said, gives me the line. John, you got a dollar? Yeah, I got a dollar. Great. I'm going to hang up now. You're going to say a prayer and take your dollar and take your big book and go to 24-hour club, buy a cup of coffee and talk to every SOB that walks through that door, tell them your story, call me in a couple hours when you're done. constant thought of others. I got to get out of me to go help you. If I'm helping me all the time, not helping you, how am I going to stay sober? I won't. You may have already asked yourself, why is it that all of us became so very ill from drinking? Doubtless you're curious to discover how and why, in the face of expert opinion to the contrary, underline this, we have recovered from a hopeless condition of mind and body. Somebody says you're always recovering, or there's no such thing as recovered. You can point them to this page and 30-something others. If you're an alcoholic who wants to get over it, you may already be asking, what do I have to do? It's the purpose of this book to answer such questions specifically. We'll tell you what we have done. Before going into a detailed discussion, it may be well to summarize some points as we see them. How many times have people said to us, I can take it or leave it alone, why can't he? Why don't you drink like a gentleman or quit? That fellow can't handle his liquor. Why don't you try beer and wine? Lay off the hard stuff. His willpower must be weak. He could stop if he wanted to. She's such a sweet girl, I should think he'd stop for her sake. The doctor told him if he ever drank again, it'd kill him, but there he is, all lit up again. Now, these are commonplace observations on drinkers which we hear all the time. Underline this. Back of them is a world of ignorance and misunderstanding. See, that's my mom sees me doing the things that I did. Her solution is, don't do that. Right? You're killing yourself. We love you. Don't do it. But until I got sober, until I could take her through this book, she didn't know what was killing me. My mama is now a big book dumper. She ain't an alcoholic. She can spot a middle-of-the-roader by the first sentence out of their mouth, though. She knows the truth about alcoholism, right? Those people react different, you know? Their solution, they get in a little trouble or whatever, and their solution is they have a bad night and get sick all over themselves on New Year's Day or whatever. Their solution is they stop. My solution was fight through it, you know? Tomorrow's another day, right? Moderate drinkers, now we're going to get into some little types here. Moderate drinkers have little trouble in giving up liquor entirely if they have good reason. They can take it or leave it. Right? Now here's the tricky guy. Then we have the certain type of hard drinker. He may have the habit badly enough to gradually impair him physically and mentally. May cause him to die a few years before his time. Here's the catch. If a sufficiently strong reason, ill health, falling in love, change of environment, or the warning of a doctor becomes operative, this man can stop or moderate. Alright? So you got the moderate drinker, he can take it or leave it. You know? It's no big deal. If he has a glass of beer with dinner, great. If not, great. Doesn't matter. And then you got the guy that's kind of confusing, right? Then you got this hard drinker type, right? And we know these people. I used to work in the bar business. I know a lot of these people. They partied with me all the time. I thought they were just like me. But time goes by, right? I'm the real alcoholic. They, on the other hand, got out of the bar business, maybe finished up college. They fell in love. They've got little babies. They don't do that stuff anymore, right? Treatment center spits these people out left and right. Given sufficient, we have a lot of these people in Alcoholics Anonymous, right? They got a DWI. They got in a little spousal spat and the cops were involved. The judge suggests Alcoholics Anonymous. They've been drinking too much. They come to Alcoholics Anonymous. We got good coffee, some pretty women. They stay. Their solution, they don't drink. They may be angry as hell, but they don't drink. But I'm not that guy. I've had all these reasons. I've had ill health. Falling in love. Falling out of love. Good jobs. Bad jobs. No jobs. I've had every reason under the sun not to pick up a drink. I drink. That sets me apart, because here it is. But what about the real alcoholic? He may start off as a moderate drinker. He may or may not become a continuous hard drinker. But at some stage of his drinking career, he begins to lose all control of his liquor consumption once he starts to drink. That allergy is in full effect. Here's the fellow who's been puzzling you, especially in his lack of control. It's twice on this page they're talking about control. He does absurd, incredible, tragic things while drinking. He's a real Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. Do you know why he uses that analogy? Other than the obvious? Robert Louis Stevenson wrote Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. He died of alcoholism. And they suspect that he wrote that book. It's kind of like an autobiography. That was him. He drank himself to death. He's seldom mildly intoxicated. I was very rarely mildly intoxicated. It's kind of like Texas Hold'em, baby. I was all in, you know. He's always more or less insanely drunk. His disposition while drinking resembles his normal nature but little. He may be one of the finest fellows in the world, yet let him drink for a day, and he frequently becomes disgustingly and even dangerously antisocial. He has a positive genius for getting tied at exactly the wrong moment, particularly when some important engagement must be kept. He is often perfectly sensible and well-balanced concerning everything except liquor. But in that respect, he is incredibly dishonest and selfish. He often possesses special abilities, skills, and aptitudes, and has a promising career ahead of him. He uses his gifts to build up a bright outlook for his family and himself, then pulls the structure down on his head by a senseless series of sprees. Is that making any sense to anybody? I bet... It'd be amazing if Alcoholics Anonymous could like form a company and build something or make something. It'd be incredible the talent we have in these rooms. Artists, engineers, you name it, lawyers. We've got great abilities. And I'd use these abilities to build up my outlook. And then, boom. Usually at the worst possible time, I start to drink. And the whole thing caves in around me. He's the fellow who goes to bed so intoxicated, he ought to sleep the clock around. Yet, early the next morning, he searches madly for the bottle he misplaced the night before. Michael touched on it earlier. We got any bottle hiders in here? Can't find the bottles, man. Where did I put them? Have y'all seen that movie, The Lost Weekend? When he's searching for that bottle and it's up in the light. And I'm like sitting there watching the TV going, it's in the light, come on. This guy needs a drink, you know. He needs a drink, man. And I lived alone and I got bottles of booze hidden everywhere and I don't know where they're at, you know. If he can afford it, he may have had liquor concealed all over his house to be certain no one gets his entire supply from him and throw down the waste pipe. Got to hide it. You got to be ingenious if you're living with somebody who might throw it away, you know. Hide it in all the good places, and toilet tanks, and under the house. And I did mine in plain daylight. I poured out a water bottle and filled it up with vodka and put it in the refrigerator. Smart drunk. I'm a smart drunk. Nobody will ever think to look there. Yeah. As matters grow worse, they get worse. Shoot. As matters grow worse, he begins to use a combination of high-powered sedative and liquor to quiet his nerves so he can go to work. Then comes the day when he simply cannot make it and gets drunk all over again. Perhaps he goes to a doctor who gives him morphine or some sedative with which to taper off. Then he begins to appear at hospitals and sanitariums. Good stuff. This is by no means a comprehensive picture of the true alcoholic as our behavior patterns vary. But this description should identify him roughly. Why does he behave like this? Why do we do it? Now we're getting to the crux of the matter, right? Why is it that I do this? If hundreds of experiences have shown him that one drink means another debacle with all its intended suffering and humiliation, why is it that we take the first drink? I mean, think about it. If you walk up to a stove and you burn your hand, the next time you walk into the stove, you're going to check. I mean, if we didn't have that kind of reaction to stuff, we'd never make it out of our childhoods. Because we'd never understand danger or fear or anything. We'd just walk out in front of cars. We'd die. The whole would be extinct. Part of our gift is for survival. But yet when it comes to drinking, knowing all that's happened to me, what does my brain come up with? This time it'll be different. I ain't going to get burned this time. Why can't he stay on the water wagon? What has become of the common sense and willpower that he still sometimes displays with respect to other matters? Perhaps there will never be a full answer to these questions. Opinions vary considerably as to why alcoholics react differently from normal people. We're not sure why, once a certain point is reached, little or nothing can be done for him. We cannot answer the riddle. You'd think the worse we got, the more we try, you know, we've tried everything, right? But we keep going back to it, over and over and over. What do those people, those normal people think? God, they must be nuts, right? They're right. We know that while the alcoholic keeps away from drink, as he may do for months or years, he reacts much like other men. We're equally positive that once he takes any alcohol, whatever, into his system, something happens, both in the bodily and mental sense, which makes it virtually impossible for him to stop. Has anybody had a long period of sobriety and then you relapse?
Yeah.
How quick did you go down? Quickly?
Immediately.
Yeah. And we get along without booze, and then once I take that drink, man, in a short amount of time, I'm on the rocks. It didn't take me anything to get there. Virtually impossible for him to stop. You know, and that's the, and I've seen it too many times just in these years that I've been sober, people that have had long-term sobriety. You know, 10 years, 15 years, 20 years. For whatever reason, they got disconnected, got off the program, did, you know, whatever reason, they went back to drinking. And you talk about some horror stories. A lot of them don't end up too good. You know? The experience of any alcoholic will abundantly confirm this. Pass it over to Mike.
All right. Not a pretty picture that just painted. You know, it says, these observations would be academic and pointless if our friend never took the first drink, thereby setting the terrible cycle in motion. Therefore, the main problem of the alcoholic centers his mind rather than his body. What a profound statement. Think about it. If I told you today I was allergic to strawberries, and I have a violent reaction to strawberries when I eat them, I start swelling up, I turn as red as this woman's shirt right here, it's horrible. And then tomorrow morning, you see me in here with a bowl of strawberries, pulling one out one by one and eating them, and start blowing up like a balloon, looking like a Macy Day float or whatever, scratching, wheezing. What is my problem? Is my problem that I'm allergic to strawberries? What are you going to be thinking? Oh, really? See, our main problem centers in our mind rather than our body. See, my problem sits squarely upon my shoulders. I've got a mind that wants to kill me and make it look like an accident. It wants to tell me it's going to be okay. Have another drink. What is the part of the equation that can't be trusted? My mind. Well, let me ask you this. What do you listen to 99.999% of your life? You're paying attention to the thing that's broke. The broken thing is calling all the shots. Think about that for a second. That's frightening. I'd have better luck pulling someone out of a state institution who's mentally impaired and saying, make all my life choices. They'd probably do better. It's an amazing thing. Oh, here's a fun one. The age-old riddle. It says, if you ask him why he started on his last bender, the chances are he will offer you any one of 100 alibis. How many hours have we spent? Why is it I drank? Why is it I did that? I need to know why I drink. Hold that thought. It says, sometimes these excuses have a certain plausibility, but none of them really make sense in the light of havoc an alcoholic's drinking bout creates. I lost my job, so I'm going to drink up the rest of my money. Makes a lot of sense, doesn't it? What a great excuse to go get drunk and devastate your life some more. I just lost my job. Makes perfect sense in my mind. You know, sometimes these excuses have a certain plausibility, but none of them really make sense in the light of the havoc an alcoholic's drinking bout creates. They sound like the philosophy of a man who, having a headache, beats himself on the head with a hammer so he can't feel the ache. If you draw this fallacious reasoning to the attention of an alcoholic, he'll laugh it off or become irritated and refuse to talk. Think about it. Have you ever wondered why you're family members and loved ones looked at you like your head was on fire as you came out of your last debacle, and they're asking you, what are you doing? You know, it's amazing. Here's a fun one. Once in a while, he may tell the truth. Have you ever actually answered that question honestly? Why is it you went out and drank last night? Have you ever actually answered it honestly? Why is it, Michael, that you knew once you start drinking, your life comes undone and horrible things happen to you? I've had loved ones ask me, why is it you knew what was going to happen? Why did you do it? And I'd make up every, because she left me, because the boss is mean to me, because of this, because of that, because my daddy was a brutal alcoholic. That's why I'd come up with every reason in the world. But a couple times I actually got bone-chilling honest and went, you know what? I don't know. And look what the next line says. It says, in the truth, strange to say, is that usually he has no idea why he took the first drink than you have. And the fact of the matter is, you can't answer that riddle. We will on the next page. I'll tell you exactly why we drink. It's going to tell us. Well, let's keep on. Some drinkers have excuses which they are satisfied part of the time, but in their hearts they really don't know why they do it. Once this malady has a hold, they are a baffled lot. Once that obsession has got a hold of us, that's the most confusing part. Later on we're going to find out, no matter the necessity or the wish, we find we cannot not drink. No matter how great the necessity, no matter how great the wish, I can't stay away from the first one to save my own life. It says, there's an obsession that somehow, someday, they will beat the game. This time it's going to be different. If I just eat me some fried chicken, nice and greasy, I can drink that Jack Daniels again and bad stuff isn't going to happen. It made sense in my mind. That was one of my beautiful thoughts. It says, but they often suspect they are down for the count. How true this is, few realize in a vague way their families and friends sense that these drinkers are abnormal, and oh, do they ever. But everybody hopefully awaits the day when the sufferer will rouse himself from his lethargy and assert his power of will. It's frightening. We've gone to the same treatment facility. The first time I went there was in 1997, but we still go there every Friday night. And they used to have family days on Sundays, and we'd go do step work with the people on visitation days. So John and I and a handful of us would be down there every Sunday afternoon doing step work with these gentlemen. And you'd see the family members circling around. Old Jimmy. Jimmy's all tore up, but you can hear the family. Jimmy says this time it's going to be different. Anybody ever said that before? I mean business this time. And you see the family's hopes rise up and rise up. And the fact of the matter is, we sit back and the chances of Jimmy surviving this thing are slim to none today. You know, and look what it says. It says, the tragic truth is, if the man be a real alcoholic, that happy day may not arrive. And there's the truth. It says, he has lost control. At a certain point in the drinking of every alcoholic, he passes into a state where the most powerful desire to stop drinking is of absolutely no avail. The tragic situation has already arrived in practically every case long before it is suspected. Many of us could have stopped early on, but we didn't want to. Unfortunately, we overshot that mark, and by the time we got to the point where we didn't ever want to drink again, it was way too late. If you want to know why you drink, here it is. The fact is, for most alcoholics, for reasons yet obscure, they have lost the power of choice in drink. Look at it. Can you control how much you drink when you start drinking? I cannot call my numbers. I have no choice in the matter. Once I start, it isn't done until I can no longer hold a bottle up and pour alcohol down my throat. That's what happens every time I pick up a drink. But that isn't even the bad part. The bad part is, I come to from another one of those tragic events, shaking like a leaf on a tree, and say, that's it, I am never going to do it again. Have you ever said to yourself, you're never going to pick up another drink as long as you live, and you meant it? People, oh, you just don't want it bad enough. BS. I've wanted it so bad it hurt. Sitting there shaking like a leaf on a tree, tears pouring down my face, I don't want to pick up another drink. 32 minutes later, what am I doing? I don't have a choice. See, John touched on it. You want to know the horror stories, and I love Alcoholics Anonymous, but inside these rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, there are a lot of people who are not alcoholics. They're a hard drinker. They got in a little trouble. Guess what? They found a way not to drink. They're lonely. They want some to hang out. They fill these rooms. They sit in here 25 years. Just fill that seat. Just keep sitting in that chair and just don't drink no matter what. Put the plug in the jug. Do what I do. Well, unfortunately, that man is not an alcoholic. There's the truth. The fact of the matter is a real alcoholic is going to drink no matter what. There is not a thing you can do about it. You are condemned to pick up that drink no matter what you do. You lock us up in a room and somehow we will escape. Think about it. The fact of the matter is, for a real alcoholic, he cannot choose whether he drinks or not. Welcome to that our lives have become unmanageable. We're not unmanageable because I've wrecked a car, I got a DWI, I've destroyed family members. All of that tragic stuff that happens as a result of drinking alcohol, guess what? You drink enough booze like we do and tragic things happen. That isn't why your life has become unmanageable. My life has become unmanageable because of the simple fact every time I say I am never going to pick up another drink as long as I live, I am unable to manage that decision to stay away from the first one to save my own life, period. That's what it means to be an alcoholic. I have lost the choice. It says their so-called willpower becomes practically non-existent, and we do have willpower. I thought I was a bad, weak-willed person for years. That's what it meant. That's why I am the way I am. And the fact of the matter is, we are the most headstrong people you have ever met in your life. We are, except when it comes to alcohol. When it comes to alcohol, our so-called willpower becomes non-existent. It is not a player. It looks great on paper, but it loses every time. Look at this. We are unable, and underline this, at certain times, because here's where the arguments come in, to bring into our consciousness with sufficient force the memory of the suffering and humiliation of even a week or a month ago. We are without defense against the first drink. And I'll have people say, that's not true. At certain times, I stayed sober for 3 years. They told me I was going to go to jail, and I didn't take a drink. Well, that's all great. But have you ever seen the game Russian Roulette before? You ever seen The Deer Hunter, the movie? It's an interesting game. You put one bullet in a revolver, and you spin the chamber, and you put the gun to your head, and you pull the trigger. You know what happens at certain times? At certain times, the gun goes boom. And you don't know when that's going to happen. And the fact of the matter is, at certain times, fear, the suffering of what we went through in the past, is not going to be able to be brought up with sufficient force into my mind. It's not that I've forgotten it's happened. It's the fact of the matter is, it's happened, but at certain times, it is not powerful enough to keep me away from the first drink. And the frightening part is that I don't know when those certain times are. Sometimes I might be able to do it, but sometimes I'm not going to be able to do it, and I can't predict either or. Left to our own devices, it's going to happen. It's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when. Welcome to being an alcoholic. It says, the almost certain consequences that follow taking even a glass of beer do not crowd into the mind to deter us. If these thoughts occur, they are hazy and readily supplanted with the old threadbare idea that this time we shall handle ourselves like other people. Yeah, I'm going to drink like my mom. 2 glasses of wine and pull up and be done for the night. I've got no experience on that. How am I going to handle myself like other people? I'm unable. It says, there is a complete failure of the kind of fence that keeps one from putting his hand on a hot stove. The alcoholic may say to himself in the most casual way, it won't burn me this time, so here's how. Or perhaps he doesn't think at all. There I am. How often have some of us begun to drink in this nonchalant way and after the third or fourth pounded on the bar and said to ourselves, for God's sakes, how did I ever get started again? Anybody been there before? All of a sudden you realize you got a drink in your hand and you're like, what just happened? Someone walked by, handed me a beer, and next thing I know I'm drinking it. And I don't even know why. It's like I can't even piece it together. Only to have that thought supplanted by, well, I'll stop on the sixth drink, or what's the use anyhow? Boy, I'm good at flying that flag, aren't I? You all know what I'm talking about. Look at this next part. When this sort of thinking is fully established in an individual with alcoholic tendencies, he's probably placed himself beyond human aid. It's an interesting concept there. Anybody ever heard that thing, lovely thing, I'm just powerless over people, places, and things? Sounds great, isn't it? Anybody think it's true? Honestly? I wish it was. If I was powerless over places, the threat of going to prison would keep me sober. Because I don't like that place. If I was powerless over people, my mother begging me and pleading me, don't pick up another drink, you're dying. If I was powerless over people, she would have kept me sober, right? How about things? Anybody have some nice things before and drink them up? Things that you really liked, houses, cars, whatever it may be, yet you drank them up. If I was powerless over things, those things would have kept me sober. So if you can't keep yourself sober, and those things I just listed off can't keep you sober, have you placed yourself beyond human aid? That's the question you have to ask yourself. And if you have, look where the game goes from there. Oh boy, unless you get locked up, you're going to die or go permanently insane. There's a fun game of let's make a deal. Which door you want to pick? One, two, or three? Locked up, die, or go permanently insane. I don't know about you, but the first time I drank and I felt the effect of alcohol, that was not on my horizon. I never thought it would take me there, but guess what? In 2000, those were my options. It says, these are stark and ugly facts that have been confirmed by a legion of alcoholics throughout history, but for the grace of God, there would have been thousands of more convincing demonstrations. So many want to stop but cannot. So many times we want to tell that newcomer, you just don't want it enough. My God, please stop telling him that. Do you remember coming in how bad you wanted to not drink? How soon we forget, a lot of us have not wanted to drink. A lot of us. It says, oh, here we go. There is a solution. What was the title of this chapter? There is a solution, but 8 pages of information before that had to convince us that there still is a problem. Let's understand the problem. Now we get to the solution, and here it is. There is a solution almost none of us like: the self-searching, the leveling of our pride, the confession of our shortcomings, which the process requires for its successful consummation. What a $10 way to say there is a solution and you aren't going to like it. But the thing you have to ask yourself is, how well did you like it out there? I don't know about you, but I was not having a good old time just partying on. Fact of the matter was, it was absolutely miserable. Here's reinforcement of step two, but we really saw it worked in others. Remember Ebby with Bill. He saw it worked. It says, and we have come to believe in the hopelessness and futility of life as we had been living it. When therefore we were approached by those in whom the problem had been solved, how about that, a recovered alcoholic, there was nothing left for us to pick up the simple kit of spiritual tools laid at our feet. We had found much of heaven and been rocketed into the fourth dimension of existence of which we had not even dreamed. The great fact is just this and nothing else, nothing less, that we have had deep and effective spiritual experiences which have revolutionized our whole attitude towards life, towards our fellows, and towards God's universe. The central fact of our lives today is the absolute certainty that our Creator has entered into our hearts and lives in a way which is indeed miraculous. He has commenced to accomplish those things which we could have never done by ourselves. How about that? I can't keep myself sober, but he can. Amazing. If you're as serious as an alcoholic as we were, we believe there's no middle-of-the-road solution. when here it is. We were in a position where life was becoming impossible, and if we have passed into the region from which there is no return through human aid, there it is again, we had but two alternatives. You notice it's no longer let's make a deal? How many of you spent years looking for door number three? Because they're going to tell you what door number one and two are, and I could have swore there had to have been a door number three. But here it is. One is to go on to the bitter end, blotting out the consciousness of our intolerable situation as best we could, living and dying in step one, taking it out to the bitter end. And the other is to accept spiritual help. What are your choices to be? Either go on the way you're going, or give this thing a shot. There's only two choices here. It says, this we did because we honestly wanted to and we were willing to make the effort. And here I love this story. This is Roland Hazard's story. And it's an amazing story. Roland came from big money. His family had money. And Roland was one of us. And his family tried to fix him every which way they could. Oh my God. They sent him all over the United States trying to fix him. So let's find out about Roland. It says, a certain American businessman had an ability, good sense, and high character. For years, he had floundered from one sanitarium to another. He had consulted the best-known American psychiatrist. Boy, did they try to fix him. Then he had gone to Europe, placing himself in the care of the celebrated physician, the psychiatrist, Dr. Jung, who prescribed for him. And it's an interesting thing because they wanted to send him to see Sigmund Freud, but Freud didn't have time to deal with Roland. So they went to Plan B. And Carl Jung had time and said he'd take him. And if you ever get a chance to study psychology at all, you're going to find out that it's 1A and 1B, the two greatest psychiatric minds known to man, still documented as Carl Jung, Sigmund Freud. So here they sent Roland to spend a year with Carl Jung. And let's find out what happened. Though the experience made him skeptical, he finished his treatment with unusual confidence. His physical and mental condition were unusually good. Above all, he believed he had acquired such a profound knowledge of the inner workings of his mind and its hidden springs that relapse was unthinkable. Self-knowledge is going to fix it, isn't it? Now he knew exactly what the problem was. He's on his way, right? The road to success. Well, let's find out. Nevertheless, he was drunk in a short time. Rumor has it, I believe he was found drunk on a train in Spain. I can stand corrected on that, but I believe that's what someone told me. He didn't make it very far in Europe, trying to get home. More baffling still, he could not give himself no satisfactory explanation for his fall. So he returned to this doctor whom he admired and asked him point blank why he could not recover. He wished above all things to regain self-control. He seemed quite rational and well-balanced with respect to other problems, yet he had no control whatever over alcohol. Why was this? Isn't that the million-dollar question? What is wrong with me? Well, he begged the doctor to tell him the whole truth, and he got it. In the doctor's judgment, he was utterly hopeless. Boy, that had to be a fun day, huh? Allegedly the best of the best to fix old Roland, and the best of the best looked at him and said, buddy, you're toast. You're hopeless. You're left with no chance of success. Wonderful. Wow, let's see where it goes. He could never regain his position in society and would have to place himself under lock and key or hire a bodyguard if he expected to live long. That was the great physician's opinion. Boy, there's a fun day, huh? It says, but this man still lives and is a free man. He does not need a bodyguard, nor is he confined. He can go anywhere on this earth where other free men may go without disaster, provided he remains willing to maintain a certain simple attitude. Some of our alcoholic readers may think they can do without spiritual help. Let us tell you the rest of the conversation our friend had with his doctor. The doctor said, you have the mind of a chronic alcoholic. And I love that word. Silkworth was the first one to introduce it to us. Chronic, what does it mean? I'm a diabetic. It's a chronic illness. Up to this point, I'm always going to be a diabetic. It's always there, left untreated. It's going to be bad. Here he's describing old Roland as you're suffering from being a chronic alcoholic, always present, always lingering, always getting worse, never better. Not a good thing. I'd never seen one single case recover where that state of mind existed to the extent that it does in you. Our friend felt as though the gates of hell had closed on him with a clang. He said to the doctor, "Is there no exception?" "Yes," the doctor replied, "there is. Exceptions to your cases such as yours have been occurring since early times. Here's some shades of hope. Here and there, once in a while." Boy, talking about building his day up, think about it. Here and there, once in a while, alcoholics have had what are called vital spiritual experiences. To me, these occurrences are a phenomenon. In other words, Dr. Young looked at it and said, you know what, there is a solution. Here and there, once in a while, throughout time, it has happened, but I have no idea how it happens. They're an absolute mystery to me. Nice. They appeared, but he knew what had to happen. And if you ever wonder, Dr. Silkworth brought us the problem, a non-alcoholic. Look who's bringing us the solution. Here it is, a non-alcoholic. Carl Jung actually introduced the solution to Alcoholics Anonymous. He didn't know how to get there, but he knew what the solution was, and here it is. They appear to be in nature of a huge emotional displacements and rearrangements. Remember Bill's story? That pretty much describes what happened to him in that hospital, wasn't it? Ideas, emotions, and attitudes, which were once guiding forces of the lives of these men, are suddenly cast to one side, and a completely new set of conceptions and motives begin to dominate them. If you want to know what a spiritual experience is, a spiritual awakening, that is what they're talking about, right there. That's the definition of it. In fact, I've been trying to produce some such emotional rearrangement with you. With many individuals, the methods which I employed are successful. He was really good with the hard drinker. He did not have any success with that chronic alcoholic. He says, but I've never been successful with an alcoholic of your description. And there it is. Upon hearing this, our friend was somewhat relieved, for he reflected that, after all, he was a good church member. This hope, however, was destroyed by the doctor telling him that while his religious convictions were very good, in his case, they did not spell the necessary vital spiritual experience. Interesting thought, isn't it? It just wasn't enough. There was something more that needed to be added to it. It says, here was the terrible dilemma in which our friend found himself when he had the extraordinary experience, which, as we have already told you, made him a free man. We in turn sought the same escape with all the desperation of a drowning man. People talk about willingness in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'll give you a better word. Someone who's willing is a great thing, but there's nothing finer than walking up and finding someone who's desperate. Because what does a desperate man do? Anything. What's the most dangerous situation you can put yourself in? Go try to save a drowning man. A drowning man does not ask you if you can swim, nor does he ask you if you've ever done this before. A drowning man climbs you like a ladder. Why? Because they're desperate for air. Think about it. A dying man desperately trying not to drink will do anything to not drink again. How about that? But look at this. It says, what seemed at first a flimsy read. Someone handing you this book and saying, do what's inside this book and it will solve the problem that has been baffling you for all these years. That's a pretty flimsy read, isn't it? Most of us are going, how is this going to help? If you get gut level honest with it, seems like a pretty flimsy read, doesn't it? But let's see where it takes us. It says, it has proved to be the loving and powerful hand of God. A new life has been given us, or if you prefer, a design for living that really works. How about that? I got a way to stay, to live and not drink. A design for living that works. The distinguished American psychologist William James, in his book Varieties of Religious Experience, indicates a multitude of ways which men have discovered God. We have no desire to convince anyone that there is only one way by which faith can be acquired. We're right back to that we have no monopoly. They told us earlier on in the foreword of the second edition. It says, If what we have learned and felt and seen means anything at all, it means that all of us, not just some of us, but all of us, whatever our race, creed, or color, are the children of a living creator with whom we may form a relationship upon simple and understandable terms as soon as we are willing and honest enough to try. Those having religious affiliations will find nothing disturbing to their beliefs or ceremonies. This thing does not conflict with any faith or religion. None. It says there is no friction among us over such matters. We think it no concern of our religious bodies. We think it no concern of ours what religious bodies our members identify themselves with as individuals. This should remain entirely a personal affair which each one decides for himself in the light of past associations or present choice. Not all of us join religious bodies, but most of us favor such memberships. And here's the thing. If you look at this, religion is a wonderful thing. But you notice what they told us? This is personal to each and every one of us. And this isn't a place to be talking about it. Could you imagine if I started talking about Christianity, and there's a Jewish person over here and a Muslim over here? What happens? All of a sudden, I'm separating the room, aren't I? All we're talking about is the power that is going to save you, and it's personal to you. And as long as we keep that, we will always be inclusive and never exclusive. How about it? It's all personal to our own affairs. Whatever your faith may be, that's a personal affair of yours, and it doesn't deter you from joining us. It says, in the following chapter, there appears an explanation of alcoholism as we understand it. Then a chapter that addresses the agnostic. Many who were once in this class are among our members. Surprisingly enough, we find such convictions no great obstacle to a spiritual experience. Do you want to know what the best-kept secret in Alcoholics Anonymous is? Here it is. Further on, clear-cut directions are given showing how we have recovered. How about that? You mean they're going to tell us exactly what to do? What a wonderful secret. It says, they are followed by 42 personal experiences. Each individual in the personal stories describes in his own language, from his own point of view, the way he established his relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and a clear-cut idea of what has actually happened in their lives. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women desperately in need, I love that word, we'll see these pages, and we believe that it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that we'll be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them too. I must have this thing. What a great chapter, huh? Love this book.
We'll take a little break, and we'll come back with chapter 3.